Hello, everyone. I am excited to be here with you today with a returning guest, Sandman. For people who don't know, Sandman is thought of as one of the OG really big voices that shaped the MGTOW movement, or the men going their own way movement. And recently, you had an interesting idea that I want to introduce to our audience.
Yeah, thanks for having me on again. So during the summer, I was actually taking care of a niece and nephew. And I came to some realizations about fertility and having children as a single father. And I thought to myself, instead of just having MGTOW be a bunch of guys who just kind of go on strike and go their own way, we could actually have fathers going their own way. So the biggest problem with a lot of guys getting married, like, you know, they would obviously don't want to get married, but the biggest problem with regards to having children is finding somebody to have children with. And that's regardless of what community you're part of. And we have surrogacy now. So, we, you know, men can go that route and have children without actually having a wife. But how would we accomplish that? And why would we accomplish that? I mean, that's something that we really need to ask.
So to word it differently, the hypothesis is, when we say the only way to get through fertility collapse is novel cultural solutions, is an perhaps intergenerational cultural group that is solely male.
I would go a little bit deeper. I'd say a group that's about 75-80% male, because you can't have a complete lack of female influence, because you need to have that in order to socialize males properly into society. And I've always advocated for a society where it was like 75-80% males, because that society would be more productive and more prosperous than other societies. And a good example of that, while I was doing research for this, is Dubai, where 75% of the population is male.
What?
So you have, yes, exactly, right? So you have this expansive masculine energy in the middle of the desert. And
how is that the case? Is
it migrant workers? I'm assuming
migrant workers, but a lot of independent male business owners, because there is very little to no tax there. So there's no personal income tax. So it attracts a lot of people that want to earn money and not.
Oh
pay
yeah,
tax.
I have like expat friends who are there that are male. Yeah, and I assume that a lot of women don't think like, oh, I want to make a lot of money. Where am I going to move? I'll live in Dubai for a while.
Yeah, I think also women who want to become entrepreneurs think about staying closer to their like social network and their social safety net, whereas more men don't have social safety nets. They can't just go back and rely on friends and family like women can. So I think that might be another factor here.
So tell me more. I'm interested. What have you seen in the Dubai culture? Have you been there?
No, I haven't, but I've got relatives that live there. I mean, I thought about moving there and I looked at all of the restrictions and it's just kind of crazy. Like you can't
when I was traveling there, it was tough.
Sorry?
It was tough. I was there over Ramadan too, so I was not that happy, especially with the alcohol situation.
Well, it's not even that. It's like if they catch you eating in your car, like off to jail, right? If it's during Ramadan, because you don't want to set a bad example to anyone. You know, I'm having some peanuts in my car. No, you're off to jail. It's like, oh, I just accidentally stumbled into some fapping material online, off to jail, right? Like it's like
this sounds like the Venezuela scene in Parks and Rec.
Well, it does, but it also sounds like, I think, what some people I feel like in the US on the like far right are advocating for these days. They're like, we need to enforce our religious value system on the population more strictly. And I'm like, it's not gonna help. Like, by the way, Dubai does not have a good fertility rate.
Well, like I said, it's a kind of like a transient place where people go make their money and kind of leave. I look at it like the Wild West. The Wild West wasn't a place for people to settle. It was people went there, mined their gold, and then went back east and started families.
So I've got a question for you. The idea that you were talking about sounds parallel to many ideas that feminists have been fantasizing about, but all women, for a long time. And yet none of these cultures has ever really been durable. Why do you think that the women never really got around to starting this, despite talking about it over and over and over again?
Well, obviously there's something missing in just complete and single female socialization. So you get this huge crime rate when it comes to single mothers, but you don't get that same crime rate with single fathers. So a society that was basically run or created by single mothers is doomed to fail.
By the way, just for people who aren't familiar with the statistics he's talking about, when you look at these single parent statistics, you get these really negative effects for kids that are raised by only mothers. However, when children are raised by only a father and it's a single parent, the difference between two parent households is minuscule. I think it's only a few percentage points difference in terms of outcomes. Now, I will note here that the primary hypothesis for this effect is that it is not a male-female thing. It's just that our courts are so biased towards women that men only get the children when, like, a woman dies or something like that. And when women get the children, it's because the two were, like, incompatible or otherwise. And two people being incompatible might just mean they're both intolerable, and that's why their children were intolerable.
I would also add that research shows that children of gay couples, specifically gay males, seem to do quite well. But again, that might be based on how difficult it is to have a child without a woman, you know, using a surrogate. So it could just be based on the conscientiousness required to do it. But yeah, the outcomes seem to be pretty good. Like, it basically, it shows that if you're willing to put in the effort to get a surrogate and you have the capability of doing so, and it's not just provided to you for free, that your kid's probably going to be okay.
There was a secondary effect, and it's something that we talked about, like, in our women asking for it video, which is to say that if you look at divorce rates, for example, and you're trying to get an understanding of, like, stability of marriages, marriages, and people are like, well, yeah, I mean, women ask for divorce more than men, but that doesn't mean that, like, it's not the male's fault that the women are asking for divorce. And so it's like, oh, well, here's a fun experiment we can run. Let's look at the divorce rate in lesbian and gay male relationships and see what it is. And it turns out when you run the experiment, divorce rates are really, really high in the lesbian community, really, really low in the gay male community. And so we actually know that the variable that is leading to the high females asking for divorces more than males in heterosexual relationships is the females themselves. They are the variable that leads to a high divorce rate. Continue.
Okay, so back to my realization this summer. So I was taking care of my niece and nephew, and I spent a lot of time at Chuck E. Cheese and a whole bunch of other places. And this is for about 2 weeks during the summer. And then I realized parenting and spending time with kids is a lot easier than I thought. And the most interesting part was all of these, like, a lot of the women that I ran into, they were interacting with me while I was out with the children. They were all saying, like, how do you do this? Like, it's so difficult. And I'm looking at them like, this isn't all that difficult. Like, there's a part of my brain that just kind of filters the children's thought process, where it's like, if there's something important, it kind of goes to the top of the pile. Whereas if it's not, it kind of just gets shuffled down in the background. And so as I continued, I realized a couple really important things. I realized our society has overindulged children so badly, and that overindulgence leads to adults who end up becoming, you know, they're spoiled as children, and then they become unhappy adults. And unhappy adults don't really want to procreate, or don't want to procreate as much, because they think to themselves, well, life sucks. Why would I bring children into this? And
To your point, there's actually been some anthropologists that have done cross-cultural analysis on child rearing. And one, Elizabeth Colbert, in a 2012 article wrote, quote, "With the exception of imperial offspring of the Ming Dynasty and the dauphins of pre-revolutionary France, contemporary American kids may represent the most indulgent young people in the history of the world," end quote.
It's not just kids in the United States. It's just a global phenomenon at this point.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously, we're seeing it. But so I looked into culture to see where we could actually find examples of this, and as a warning. And the best example I found was Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Because you have Charlie, and he's this humble, kind child. And then you have the other four kids. So you got Augustus. He's basically overindulging in gluttony and with food. You get Veruca Salt. She's overindulging with materialism and consumer wealth. Then you get Mike TV, and he's overindulging with the dopamine rush from television. And then you get Violet, who's, you know, overindulging with narcissism and overconfidence. And so you see, so now take these kids who are in the 50s and 60s who had all of that, and put them in the 70s, and now all of a sudden the fertility rates crash, right? So that, go ahead. You're going to say something.
No, you're right. I was trying to remember, what was Mike TV in the original? Didn't they change his vice?
No, he just, I think he was it television? I don't know. Like, but I remember, well, his name was TV, so obviously he's going to watch TV.
Oh, you know, it was Mike TV in the original and it was video games in the remake.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
It was always TV.
Yeah. So, go ahead.
No, I mean, I think that you're absolutely right about this. And I also think that the idea that a male, so there's something that you touched on that I don't want to let go unsaid, which I'm going to call the pregnancy conspiracy, or the child rearing conspiracy, which is that we created a set of social conditions that basically encouraged women sort of as a cabal to increase the amount that they signaled that child rearing was really, really difficult. It's almost like a union. Like, that's what feminism was, a union of women that were trying to convince the foremen, their husbands, right, that they needed more time to do a specific job. And so it was sort of always in their individual best interest, because males often couldn't feel what some of the labor that they were doing was like and wouldn't have access to that, to constantly signal how difficult it is. And, you know, you look at like our family, Simone and I take the kids when they're older, and it is mostly like fun. Like, that's what being around the kids is. It's not particularly a burden at all. I will note, if you attempt to do this, one thing you are going to find is that the first year around, or I'd say year and a few months of life for the child, is going to be uniquely hard for you, just because you're not biologically programmed to handle that phase.
I wouldn't say everyone. So there's like, I would say 1 out of 30 men, great with babies, loves babies.
Rasheed Khan, really good with babies.
And other people we've met too. I'm not going to, I guess I shouldn't name names, but like just an instant, really good with babies. But that is not the majority of men. So in other words, like, if you don't love your newborn, don't worry, it gets better.
Yeah, it gets a lot easier after the first like year and 2 or 3 months once they start like becoming humans.
So my realization was, so I thought to myself, okay, for like, if I started off, like, I don't do anything small. Like, just like you guys, you're like, we're going to have like 15 kids, whatever, right? So for me, it was like, okay, how many kids would I want? I think 4 would be a good number as a single father, right? So I thought about it, and what I noticed in the interactions between my niece and nephew, she's about 4 or 5 years older. So whenever he would get emotionally like hurt or something would happen, she would nurture him naturally. So my strategy would be to have a daughter first and have her for 3, 4, 5 years, and then start to bring in the sons in rapid succession.
It would work. So there's actually, Simone was noting this to me. She's like, yeah, all the large families I know, the oldest daughter always ends up actually doing a lot of the work of the child rearing. Now, a lot of people would call this parentification, and they get all mad at us for talking about it. But it's like, yeah, but it works. And they wouldn't not want their siblings to exist, you know, once they get to know them. So I don't know if, I think the reason why progressives in the urban monoculture get so mad about this concept of parentification is they just don't like the idea of somebody having expectations, like, i.e. responsibilities.
Although I would counter to say that the value in having 2 to 3 boys first and then a daughter, is that I think the daughter will still naturally have an instinct to help around more on average. But I kind of like having, we have 2 older boys, and we chose to have 2 older boys,
2 girls. Yeah.
And they will never really, based on their personality, come across as like this beleaguered, you know, always kind of minding after servant child, that often many eldest daughters come off as. And there's definitely this feeling that you get from that. And it almost, I mean, to them, it's sort of this feeling of disempowerment. We never really worry about that.
It's a good point, because also if you have that daughter there first, then they're going to get used to being given that attention and that nurturing. So
and that's a good skill for men to have. I feel like they're already going to be like boys, but now you're giving them an opportunity to sharpen a skill that many boys don't ever get to sharpen, which is taking care of other people, which is a really good, especially like in dating markets and in life, an insanely good skill. Like a man who can take care of other people, both men and women,
I actually think we might have made a mistake by having the two boys first.
I had this thought
recently when taking care of the three of them.
Okay.
Where I was like, it would be remarkably easier. Like for me as a parent, if the oldest was a girl, it's not that Octavian doesn't help parent the others, but it's in a very different way. It's more like, you know, because I've got three now, I can never keep one from running. You know, you can't possibly catch them all when you're at the zoo or at the play place. And so with Octavian, you know, when his little brother or his little sister runs off, I can tell him, you know, basically sick him, you know, go get him. And he'll run and he'll grab them. I remember we were at the Philadelphia Museum of like explorey things. I can't remember what it's called, but it's for like little kids. Torsten had gotten really far from me. It must have been, you know, all the way across like the atrium and down a stair level. And so there was no way that anyone could know me. And so his big brother was running after him, tackled him, and then was dragging him back up the stairwell. Cause it was one of those flat, like spiral stair things. And the guards were like running up to him and like really worried about why is this one child like abducting this other child? And I was like yelling, no, it's okay. That's what he's supposed to do. But I also think that they weren't even like used to the idea that like one child would go bop another child, grab them and like bring them back, like a caveman brings his wife back to like the clan. And I think that if I had a daughter, she'd find a less potentially politically damaging way of resolving her siblings running.
Do we want that? Because we want tough girls, right? And we want caring boys. And that's why I'm actually holding even more so to my guns.
But if I was a single dad, I would definitely do girl first. Because they're going to have a skill set that I'm not going to have, especially with young.
That's fair. I could see that with if you're taking the single father approach, I could see that. Yeah.
The greatest criticism people were saying, I passed this idea around, and women were just absolutely livid about me having a daughter first. Because right, I'm like, well, if I have a son first, then you're like, well, you must be like a, you know, a PDF file, because you know how like. Like, so, but if you have a daughter first, well, you just want a servant and a slave. So it's like you can't win the argument on both sides. And
you'll never get, you know, social affirmation. Don't worry about it.
Well, I mean, but it's important to kind of keep these things in mind, because I know you guys were visited by the authorities.
We were.
A few times. But did you know that 73% of children in America are visited by CPS?
No, I didn't know. That's pretty high stat.
Doesn't it make you feel a little better?
I mean, it's just like having nutritious food in your fridge. Okay, that's pretty straightforward. And it's just the idea that for you, it was each kid needs their own room. That seemed to be kind of.
Oh, like, yeah, that was one thing.
There are so many things that we got in trouble for.
they are completely unreasonable in their expectations. But I actually really like your idea to attempt to do this at scale. Start with a girl. I think you're making the right call. And I think the real big important reason to start with a girl is for year one. Year one is just so hard as a guy. You are, and I was realizing, I was thinking about it. I was like, humans in year one are more like a pupa than they are like a small human. So I'll explain what I mean by this.
Around newborns. I understand that. My whole thing would be, like, for me, the two biggest barriers have always been like health-wise. Like it's not even financial, so to speak. Like if I hired a nanny to help me for at least, you know, 6 months to a year, that would get me through that time period.
Even need to though. You just wear the baby. And every 3 hours, you make sure that you feed them and change their diaper.
Yeah.
It sounds easy, but here's the problem. They don't like eating.
Yeah,
this is what's not communicated to you. You think, oh, I'll just give them a bottle and they'll drink it. And it's like, no, they don't drink it. And then you look and you think, is they going to die if I skip this feeding? And then how many times can you do that?
Yeah, I guess Malcolm is not. He's not up for it. He's not up for the battle. Yeah, maybe hire someone.
I'm not going to hold it there. And an older daughter would do that.
But I'm saying when the daughter is first there, then that's pretty much when I would need the help, right?
At the beginning.
So, but yeah, it's like, another thing I just thought of when you were bringing up the travel, you guys went to a museum. I think travel is also one of the overindulgences. So you have to be careful to not get them too hooked to these novel places and, you know, novel ideas, because then they're just going to get more and more hooked to it. And eventually they'll run out of places to explore as they become adults. So for me, it's kind of like, I'm thinking raising children relatively poor up until the, you know, maybe 7 or 8, because that's kind of what happened with me, because my parents came from Eastern Europe and I didn't have all of the things that the other kids around me had when I was younger. And it wasn't until I got those things at 7 or 8 that I actually appreciate them, right? So go ahead.
Oh, no. I mean, so this reminds me of a concept we've been talking about, and we've got to do a video on eventually, Simone, which is childhood maxing. And so we've been thinking about, like, okay, from a cost perspective and a scale perspective, how do we maximize the experiences of our children's childhoods? And this sort of came up when we were on a trip with our kids, and I was like, what's the point of this? Like, why are we traveling with the kids?
And yeah, specifically, we flew all the way with our 4 kids to Telluride, Colorado, because we had very generously been gifted a place to stay there for some nights, and we just went to a creek and threw rocks in the water, and that was what we did there, and that's kind of what we can do right in, like, our backyard.
We do that in our backyard, you know.
So why did we just fly to do that?
You know, so what I've tried to do is now every single weekend day I do. So 2 times a week, I take the kids for at least half the day and I do some sort of novel stimulus, whether it's a creek or it's on a little inflatable boat or it's like catching crayfish or it's in a park or it's at a museum or it's at a zoo. And a lot of these things are very inexpensive things to do, but they're very, like, scalable, and they provide as much novel stimuli as trips, but I, like, force myself to do it more frequently. And I realize that this has dramatically increased the time I'm spending with my kids. And it also helped me understand, recently we did something on the Sam Bankman-Fried, Sam Altman, UBI study. And we pointed out that when people were given an extra $1,000 a month for 3 years, they didn't increase the time they spent with their children. And I realized that the function that changed the amount of time I was spending with my children wasn't like extra resources. I actually have less resources now than I've had historically. It was just deciding I'm going to make it happen.
Sam, and I'll just add, I think you are totally spot on here that kids are... Our kids so far, although we've only made it to age 5 so far, totally unsensitive to product quality or price on anything. Cardboard boxes are among the hottest commodity in our household.
Yeah, period. So you're raising a bunch of cats then.
Yeah, we do it. Like, it is so dumb for us to spend any amount of money on anything ever, because it, like, there's no correlation between spending.
No, I mean, children are amused by the most simple things, right? Like, you can go to the dollar store and buy a bag of balloons, and now you've got like 5 hours of balloon fun.
Or
you
take,
like, you talk about streams. You guys are in the middle of Pennsylvania, I guess, but around here, Lake Ontario, I took them to Lake Ontario, and they were just going crazy for like 4 hours, and they're like, "This is great," and I'm like, "Well, but the parents need to take them to Cuba." They need to take them and then it's like, well, the beach here isn't as nice as Cuba. It's like,
I don't think the kids notice. And honestly,
they're less comfortable. They're less happy because they can't get dinosaur nuggets in Cuba. They can't, you know, watch, you know, their normal stuff. They don't have their normal friends or whatever. Travel's not fun for kids. Travel becomes fun, I would say, at the earliest age 16 for kids. Maybe a little younger, but
yeah, I agree.
It's
with
your
that,
perception of time, right? Like, if you're stuck in a car, your time just drags on. And like, I mean, realistically, with travel, you can't value it. Like, you're right, until about 16, 17, and then even then, if people pay for your travels, you don't appreciate it. So, for example, for me, I've traveled to 20, 25 countries, but I paid my way to all of those places. I organize my itineraries. I do these elaborate trips, and everyone's like, "Well, it's so nice to do that." I'm like, "Well, organize a trip and see what it's like." And they're like, "Well, this is too much work." I'm like, "Travel is a full a job for me anyway, especially if I'm traveling and filming videos and editing videos on the road trips, right?" So, go ahead.
That's really cool. One thing I've noticed larger families do when they do want to expose their children to the world, but at an affordable way. And my dad actually did this with me, is they will take one of the children with one parent when that one parent has to go on a business trip. And that child just does whatever they do during the trade show or the conference or whatever.
I don't know if I agree with that. I would do more of like a gap year style. I like your 16 thing. Basically, let the kids go on a trip and plan a trip themselves at 16. Ooh, if they want to do that.
That's a cool idea.
I will notice that the environments that kids actually gain additional like happiness from in child maxing are actually a pretty constrained preset set of environments. So we're really talking beaches, creeks, lakes, woods.
I would say pools. And pools also count.
Pools. And if you're hitting those things, you're hitting pretty much everything a kid wants to do until the age of like 14.
Yeah, I mean, I took my niece and nephew a couple weeks ago to a stream, and they just sat on a rock and watched the water. And they're like, I'm like, well, it's time to go. It's like, no, we don't want to go. And it's like, well, okay. It's like, as long as you just watch them don't fall in the water, that's fine.
Wait, they didn't throw stones in the water? Those kids are deformed.
There were no stones. There were no small stones to throw in. They were all just very large.
Boulders.
Yeah. So
our kids would be into that. They would, yeah.
See, like I was mentioning earlier with health conditions. So I've had a problem with eczema. So for example, when the winter comes, I am in horrible pain. So for me, I have to move. So my whole thing would be to be 6 months in the Northeast and then 6 months in a place like Florida. So
nice.
So I would have to homeschool. There's no way that I would be able to basically put them in schooling until they were in high school, obviously. And I would, at this point, I think homeschooling is the way to go, because you're getting a lot of feminine energy and overindulgence in the school system. So how are you guys addressing that?
You know, it's funny that you mentioned this, because we actually had one of our fans reach out to us right now. Like, the last couple of weeks has been like a series of emails from fans about why they're pulling their kids out of the school system, because more and more people are starting to use the Collins Institute, which is like our free alternative. And one of the ones that was recently is, they're like, our daughters have figured out that they just like throw a fit and they can get what they want from teachers, right? And we have tried to tell the teachers to stop indulging them, you know, stop sending them to the counselors. Like, if they're learning something they don't want to, just throw a fit, get sent to the counselor, whatever. And it's like, you need to stop indulging them, they say to the teacher, but the teachers don't care, because that's the culture that is dominant in schools right now. And the strategy that we're using with our kids is go to school until they don't want to. And then it's their responsibility to achieve whatever metrics they need to on standardized testing to stay out of the school system.
I for a while I was dropping off my niece and nephew at the schools and picking them up in a few times. So like, what I noticed is the security, it's like going into a prison or going in and out of a prison. You got to sign in, you got to sign out. You can't allow kids to walk to school, because that's considered a child abuse now. I'm like, how is, like, I was walking to school at the age of 5 or 6 going to kindergarten.
Same, yeah.
So you're eliminating their ability to have self-reliance. You know, and then on top of that, I just came across an article a couple days ago. A woman got in trouble because her 14-year-old was babysitting her kids. Like, so you can't, like, how old, you know, they could be 16 or 18 to, you know, centuries ago, women at the age of 14 were already having 2 or 3 kids, and now you can't even babysit a kid.
Yeah, and in the UK, it's even more strict. You have to have like really specific licensing. So you can't even hire your 40-year-old neighbor who's also a parent and just randomly to babysit your kids, for example.
Oi, you got a license for that babysitter? Oh, shit.
Insane. Just so unsustainable. Yeah. I mean, one thing I was thinking when you were describing that is we, for a while, were thinking about spending 6 months of every year in Lima, Peru, where we have business, and then 6 months in the United in a house
and never 6 months.
Yeah, well, we were going to, but like we were going to do the opposite, where we had perpetual winter because we prefer the cold and darkness. But you could just do the flip side, and a benefit of doing something like that in a country like Peru is then the kids could learn Spanish, experience a different culture, that kind of thing. So it's always an option. But the question is, where, and do you want to go through the trouble of buying property? abroad or something like that.
I mean, I've got to look at places in terms of my skin conditions that are relatively hot, but also have high humidity. So I can't, like, I looked at Dubai. It's too dry there. Like, I looked at Cyprus. Cyprus is also a good place. Also too dry. The Southwest, I would have gone to do that too. But again, too dry.
Too dry.
So the only places that kind of work for me that are still...
Lima year-round, right? Lima's pretty wet, right?
Lima's quite wet.
I mean, it's in a desert. It is in a desert, but it's next to the coast, which makes it slightly more humid? I don't know. I'd have to look up.
Yeah.
I mean, I looked at the best place for me is Florida, but... But
Florida's Florida. Sandman, don't do it. Don't do it.
Why?
Don't do it. You don't know what you're getting into. No, I'll be honest. We lived in Florida. I grew up part time in Florida. It is one of the most miserable places in the world. It's not as bad as like LA, but like it's close.
Miami's miserable. I didn't find Miami miserable. Like I've been to
Miami where we lived. Yeah, I hated Miami.
Oh, humidity 76%.
The
Lima, Peru. That's pretty good. Miami, right?
Is what draws people to Miami, which is an image and a lifestyle that is really so the problem that you have with Miami, right, is of all the cities like in the world that I've ever lived, if you divide the cost of living by average income, it's like the worst number you'll get in any city.
It's worse than Toronto. It's really worse than Toronto. So I looked at property like compared to the south, like southern Florida compared to Canada, it's still cheaper to some extent. So I looked at, it's gotta be my threshold. No, it's gotta be
average income. I mean, the average income in Toronto is going to be way higher than Miami.
I don't know. Like this place is not like the per capita income of Canada is declining pretty rapidly.
Oh, I guess you're right. Yeah.
Yeah. So how do I say this? It's kind of like, you gotta look at multiple factors. So for me, the temperature can't drop below 10 degrees Celsius at night. That's when my problems start. So that the only places that kind of keep above that are anything from Port St. Lucie down to the Miami and the Keys below, or the on the west side, like just south of Fort Myers. So that's kind of the zone that I would have to be in.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. Is it St. Peter, Florida that I'm thinking of?
St. Petersburg you're thinking of.
Yeah, there's like a small cute town in Florida that's like really nice. But anyway, yeah. Okay. I like this. Okay, so what are the next steps of this plan?
So right now I'm just getting there. In the next 3 to 4 years, I should be able to retire fully. So I could basically have full income coming in terms of dividends, in terms of assets. I can buy multiple properties, all that wonderful stuff. So that's perfectly fine. Yeah. Then I can switch my channel over and maybe start documenting a lot of this stuff and make it fathers going their own way. So that way I can allow this to kind of catch on with other people. So I think that's kind of important and kind of set an example. But this is also
would you try to create any sort of community with pooled childcare or any other sorts of resources where like there's not necessarily living in a commune, but people living in the same city, for example?
I mean, I could do that later, but right now my biggest fear would be getting a lot of negative attention and getting a lot of feminists coming after me, not only trying to strike my channel, but also calling child protective services, child custody. So there's going to be a lot of pushback. I don't want the media kind of attacking me. Like, you guys put yourself out there, you put a target on your back. Right. So you're going to get all kind of disgruntled people coming.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, like the undercover reporter, all that, like we get targeted constantly recently. It's really becoming more of an issue in daily life.
Well, you're attacking the established ways, values of the society. So
actually, fun question I have for you, because you were mentioning you were getting a lot of strikes recently. One thing that's been a problem for us recently is, have you noticed that Google has moved to an AI based system for determining if episodes are eligible for monetization?
Well, look, I get maybe 10 to 20% of my videos just automatically demonetized. So what I do now is mostly memes of the week videos. And what they do is sometimes they'll put a time code, and then I can just swap out a different meme with another meme. And then I just upload it again, and then it passes the filters. So you have to kind of adapt, but it's harder to do that with long form content because you're like, you don't want to chop the thing up into thousands of little pieces. So
wow. But, I also don't know what's getting us flagged these days. Like it's weird. The things that got us flagged.
Did you find out what was getting, did you get the timestamp in your videos?
Wait, did it give you a timestamp?
I'm not talking for me, about it gives copyright. Me a timestamp. It says at this point it is this type of content or this, you know, like if you go through the report, it should say it.
It doesn't. I'll check, but I haven't found that for us. For us, it's like really vague.
Well, what were the like community? What were the community guideline violations? What did they say? Like, what they must have given you a reason. They have to say something.
One of the things that was said recently by Rubyard that I found really telling, and I thought, you know, personally was pretty interesting. Oh, view feedback. It can tell me.
Okay.
No, it doesn't say. A human reviewer rated your video as suitable for limited ads. What? It doesn't tell me why. This was the one on a 230x increase in fentanyl deaths in 10 years.
Okay, so it was most likely drug related. So they don't want ads on things that are talking about drugs. So as long as you don't talk about adult content or drugs, or you don't talk about illicit substances,
Damn, man, we can't do that.
No, you can't.
I can't. What are we talking about? This one doesn't tell me why it's limited. What is this? Okay.
Wait, what video is that?
This one is research in the Bible. Fapping is good.
Yeah, and Malcolm.
Talking about self indulgence. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Okay. Antifa, a deep dive. But that
you're talking about Antifa. Don't talk about.
I know that's like my point here is like there's just sort of no way with Basecamp. Like
it's the title. It's most likely the title that's doing it, right? Because if you put those specific keywords in the title, it will automatically hit you. Like most of my videos, it just says memes of the week. There's nothing offensive about that. So every single video pretty much gets through for the title.
Nice. Yeah. All right. Most people are self-censoring with so many words that we use on this podcast that we just don't do anything about.
I had to start self-censoring after the first adpocalypse in 2016? Yeah, 2016, 2017. And at that point, it started. Before that, you could pretty much get away with saying anything.
Wow. Well, it was good.
Oh my gosh.
I want to go back to this. So I like this idea. I like this idea of turning this into a sustainable way of life. And I think the key thing with prenatalism, and this is a point that Malcolm makes, but it's not made a lot, is that with the Industrial Revolution, we opened a Pandora's box, culturally speaking, technologically speaking, that cannot close. Like we had sort of a model that worked where families lived without tech in households where everyone depended on each other and kids were part of their economic production and their retirement plan. And with the Industrial Revolution, that whole model ended. Culture changed significantly. We had globalization. Basically, we can't go back to the old ways and reasons of having kids, and we have to invent new ones. And this is a very valid new way to have kids.
What really got me thinking, like you guys with actually selecting the embryos, which is kind of what nobody else is really, well, there are people doing it, but not so much. So I decided that's probably the route that I would go. But I also had an existential crisis in being like, well, what gives me the right to choose which child makes it and which one doesn't? And so, and then, you know, the whole idea of dysgenics and, you know, because half the children never would have made it past the age of one or two, that's your natural selection. So we have to, you know, do we want to play God in a sense? Well, we have to because we're already playing God by having all these fertility aids. It's just that one way of playing God is socially acceptable and the other way is not. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, selecting for specific qualities would be very important. And you were also, I was watching one of your videos and Simone, you were talking about how you're an extreme introvert and that's me. So being around children or noisy children all the time, wanting your attention, it kind of gives you that anxiety and kind of you're like, I just need some time alone. And then you said something about how your own children, some of them, you could definitely tell that they were also heavily introverted.
And thank goodness.
But is that something that you can actually select for, or is that just kind of a roll of the dice?
So we did there. I have not seen in our experience any polygenic scores related to introversion. So I think the key is, and it, Malcolm is very introverted. I'm very introverted. So our odds, of course, of rolling the dice and getting introverted kids somewhat better, though I would say not of a lot. Like so far, one of our children is almost certainly not going to be introverted. So it's not
Which
always going to work.
Which one is that?
Titan.
Maybe. I mean, so Titan's personality is dominated primarily by mischievousness, but to the point that it pretty much wipes out any other trait that she has.
But anyway, most of them are very introverted. I would say when you look for your egg donor, really try to work that out.
Yeah. I mean, that's I would basically get them to, like, there's the Jordan Peterson test for high in openness and high introversion. You can do all. So I would make sure, like, that to me is more important than physical appearance and height and all these other characteristics, because I think that obviously IQ is obviously a big determining factor for success, but I also think IQ is kind of just processing power. I don't see it as I don't see it as the driving force. I think that having very high openness and creativity is far more important.
And there's sort of just this ambition and raw drive and vitality that you're looking for too, that just some people don't have. And that is going to matter so much more than intelligence, especially in a post AI age where we have access to to AI intelligence. We sort of have an infinite, we can tap into that somewhere else. It's more about having some common sense and then a lot of drive.
This is actually something with your kids that'd be interesting is keep in mind how much easier AI is just going to make everything.
But it waters it down. Like, I mean, you were creating music using AI and I've done the same as well. And what I noticed is it's kind of mid-range. It doesn't create the top end. Right. And if you're a highly creative person, you're searching for those next level experiences and you can't get that from AI as much.
Kids aren't going to get mid-ranged most of anything. You know, if you're thinking education, you're getting like a minimum wage employee. Like almost everything a kid experiences is below mid-range when it comes to like personal experiences.
I mean,
what do you mean?
I mean, look, with kids, you're not paying for the best of the best to interact with them personally. But with AI, you can get them over mid-range. Think of like a music tutor, for example. An AI is going to be a higher quality music tutor than a human for a kid, or an art tutor or a teacher or I think that this is where it's going to get interesting, or somebody to watch them to make sure they don't kill themselves. That's the AI I want on the market the most right now. Which is an AI camera that can just watch my room of kids and like send me an alert when one of them is about to kill themselves.
or climb up the side of the house like I saw in one of your videos as a kid.
Oh yeah, I love that. My parents told me that and I didn't believe it. We were going through old tapes and it's just us climbing.
Was that your uncle or your dad just sitting there like completely indifferent at the table?
That was my granddad. Yeah,
yeah, his granddad. Yeah, well, and you have both parents just don't care, but that is how parenting is done right. That is
it's like that numbers game, right? Like if you have four kids, then you don't have to worry. Like you're like, well, if one dies, it's like, well, you don't want it to die, obviously, but it's kind of you're also like that's part of it too in terms of the numbers game.
No, I agree. I actually think we sort of need to reach that mindset as a society to raise kids successfully, which is to say that like, but they're not all gonna survive. And people are like, oh, no, that's so horrible. And it's like, yeah, but then you don't take them to the woods because you've watched too many 411 stories and you don't let them, you know, like at the end of the day, if you're not OK with putting your kids in dangerous situations, then you're not OK with them getting like a full set of experiences.
But it's also kids don't recognize dangerous situations because they don't hear stories of other kids being hurt. Like, you know, when I was growing up, it was like, oh, that kid, you know, a few blocks over was kidnapped and ended. Right. It's like, I better be careful when I'm walking home from school alone as a 5-year-old. It's like, you know,
I mean, you wouldn't actually. I understand why fairy tales exist now, because I make up so many fairy tales for our kids to be like, well, obviously you can't go outside because the witches will take you and eat you. And obviously you can't do this because you'll turn into
a monster. But our kids don't get scared easily. So Simone did this with our kids kept running away in the woods, and Simone was like, well, you'll be eaten by like a monster. And she's like, a bear is a monster, right? So she showed them like a lot of videos of like bears catching and eating deer, like killing and eating them alive. And The kids would like watch them and then ask to see more videos. They're like, oh, I'm going to go to sleep. Can I see more bear videos? And like you just wandering. Weren't able to terrify them.
Well, yeah, you know, I took my niece and nephew to an African lion safari. So there's literally lions walking around the car. And my nephew's like, I want to go home now. Like he sees the lion walking past the car, like past his window. And he's like, that's a giant lion. It's like, I want to go. And so, but
he's smart.
He is, but here's the problem. Like as we drove through the safari, we went to the paddock that was all just herbivores, and there was like giraffes hovering above the car. They completely lost all attention span. They just wanted to go. They didn't want to be there looking at animals that were literally around the car. And I think this is how oversensitized, like everyone is getting. They're overindulgence of experiences. Like, you know, Malcolm, you're right. Take them to the zoo, but don't take them like every year or every month. Take them once every couple years so they actually value that experience, right?
I mean, well, here's the problem. Even if you take them once every couple of years, the oversensitization doesn't happen to the actual events. It happens to the things around the event. So if I was going to word this differently, it's the fireworks problem, right? In our generation, fireworks, ooh, wow, amazing. The generation before us, before TV, fireworks, oh, so spectacular. Now, you know, you show a kid fireworks, even if it's only once per year, and they might be like, I mean, I can get better in a video game, right? So I think a lot of the oversensitization comes from just the things they have access to.
Yeah, but so that means you have to restrict access to some extent. You have to allow boredom to set in. And so therefore they can value things. And so, I mean, you guys are a little bit younger than me. So when I was, let's say about 8 or 9, that's when Nintendo came out. So the original NES. Yeah. So before that, video games were just like punishment. They weren't really fun, right? Like it was just like, you know, like Pong or, you know, Atari. It was brutally bad. Like you didn't want to play that. There was no interest in that. So after that, that's when the dopamine spiked. Like I remember playing games in 87, 88, and the dopamine was just like going through my brain massively. Mm. So I think that restricting a lot of those technologies is pretty much the way to go. Like how are you guys with tablets and?
Oh no, I don't really restrict that much. I mean, we do a little bit of restriction, but like the general idea we have around this is one of the things with kids is that if you restrict, if you have a number of kids, like now it's not so bad for us because they can play together. But like a lot of people are like, oh, I'll restrict my kids' access to tablets, but like I'll interact with them. And it's like, yeah, but kids get bored of you in like 5 minutes. Tablet or no tablet, like kids just don't like interacting with adults for long periods of time. And so what we have found works really well for our kids is 90s media.
Yeah.
Magic School Bus, Bill Nye the Science Guy, all of that. Like,
yeah, I watched your video on the Magic School Bus, or the horrific school bus.
Can you believe that happened in the show? I was like, what?
It shows how far we've fallen.
I know. Hold on. She actually had a fish jizz on her students, and they were like, this is a normal thing to have in a kid's show to teach them about fertilization. And I was like, you could not do this today.
No, you, well, yeah, obviously, right? But yeah. So the media, like the technology and the content, you have to kind of select the content. I find a lot of the content's pretty milquetoast today anyway. You know, so they'll watch like Spider-Man, the animated Spider-Man for kids kind of thing, which
bad.
Is
bad. It's bad. Well, one listener of this podcast suggested something that I'm really keen to try. She's mostly not for screens, but when she does need to put her kid down with the screen, which most people who are reasonable do, she plays home videos of their vacations, time together, things like that. And I really want to try that.
They love that kind of stuff. I would film things like, you know, just sitting on a streetcar traveling around, and they just love, just, you know, if you film half an hour of them just sitting on a streetcar, they'll just watch themselves in the streetcar for half an hour and look around in the city, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah. I think if everyone could take the time to put that together, like this one parent I know did, Malcolm, you know, I got to do it sometime. But no, this is very intriguing. I'm excited about this concept. I want also this lesbian utopia too. I want everyone to have their
thing. Lesbians will fight too much. That's the problem, Simone. That's what we've seen from the statistics.
I know well, here's the funny thing though, and this is where I get so confused, is you still though have a lot of these more traditional communities, or like Viking communities, or Even during the American Revolution, where all these wives are at home, they're raising kids by themselves, you know, in communities full of other wives raising the kids because all the husbands are gone at war, or they're off exploring or whatever, and they're fine. And the men are all off together and they're fine. And those seem to work. But then when like people try to do it on their own, it falls apart. And I don't get it. But I mean, things are totally different now. We're playing with a totally different game board. The rules are different. The physics are somewhat different, and therefore, innovation is necessary.
Well, the lack of stimulation is not the problem. It's selecting the proper stimulation is right. I think that's kind of where we're at now. Mm. Right. So, like growing up, it was a lack of stimulation, too much boredom. That was in the 80s. So I can't imagine what it'd be like growing up right now. But now, another thing that kind of like pissed me off was, you know, you get people who grew up in poverty and who didn't have much. Like, for example, Gary Stevenson. I don't know if you've run into the Gary Stevenson's YouTube channel.
No, tell me about his stuff.
He is an economist in the UK, and he was like the number one trader in the world back in the early 2010s. He was making money off of interest rate trades for a Citibank, and he won this like card game, and then they basically selected him like to work for them, to basically be an intern. And then he worked his way up in the company and like was the number one trader, but he left because he saw the massive wealth inequality. And he saw how the only people that were really being the traders were the children of already wealthy people. So the only people that could get those jobs that could make millions a year were the ones that already were extremely wealthy to begin with. So his whole channel is basically fighting against wealth inequality. And, the problem is he wants to tax people who have over $10 or $20 million more. It makes sense from the standpoint of extreme wealth inequality, because as the middle classes collapse and disappear, you're not going to be able to sustain the social welfare system, right? So that's really what it's coming down to. But even he made lots of money, and he doesn't want to see his kids suffer, and he's giving his kids a better life. And then you get people like Andrew Tate, and he's also giving his kids a better life. But what they forget is that they came from nothing, and it's that nothing that made them something, and that battle, that constant fight to move forward. And if you give your children too much, you rob them of that, like, hunger and desire to fight for more.
No, I think you're absolutely right, and it's this interesting push and pull you have in society, which is that you need some sort of like artificial scarcity or hardship for kids. But generating it, and as a wealthy family, you need to think about this. So one of the things that I think a lot of these people are missing, and this was really elevated for me by the BMI study, not BMI, UBI study, that showed that when you give people like additional money, they actually end up less wealthy. And that it appears that most people in our current society are not in that position because of how much money they have or how much money they started with, but because if you gave them $1 million tomorrow or even doled it out to them over time, they'd be back where they are today in 5 years, just because that's their natural capabilities.
Because they're not being taught to manage their money at a younger age, right? You have to, I've tried to like not lecture, but just kind of mentor a couple kids in their teens about finances. It's like pulling teeth. I can't get them to like open a term deposit because they're like, that's a scam.
Whoa.
Yeah. It's difficult because they're like, oh, I want to immediately buy Nvidia shares. I'm like, do you realize like you need to understand how all of the whole financial system works? Like you need to own assets, but you need to own like a specific combination of assets. And then why are you buying assets? And you know, you need to practice these things before you actually, you know, drop all your money into it, right? And that's something they're not doing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Again, so I think that there's a combination of, yeah, a lot of this is sort of like a preset thing, where people are sorting into the positions that they would have in society, but then also a lot of people who are born into wealthy families that don't have good cultures around creating intergenerational wealth end up overly pampered, basically. And I see this with a lot of our wealthy friends. Like, I know their kids are effed. Like, yeah. I'm like, you cannot do this. You cannot have a 24/7 tutor for every kid you can.
Well, I think the key thing, though, is, and this makes me so much more comfortable because we were worried about making our kids too comfortable, is siblings are great. There's such an easy solution for this, especially if you may have money, But if you don't get like a nanny for each kid and you have a lot of kids, those kids will experience hardship, deprivation. Mm-hmm. They will have things constantly taken from them. I mean, it's a very frustrating
system.
It's
as simple as like a lack of personal space, right? Like you don't have as much personal space. That's going to make you crave more personal space. And as you get older, you're going to be like, well, how do I earn more money so I can get more personal space? And then
a lot of like, there are many scarce, quiet personal space, parental attention, lots of scarce commodities. You have to learn how to emotionally regulate earlier. And also a key element of development that I think is often associated with hardship, but isn't necessarily, is what I would call rough and tumble play, which is that when kids play, it's often about pushing boundaries and pissing each other off. And when you have kids that are raised single, they typically just appeal to authority when that happens. Instead of just figuring out amongst themselves. And if you don't work out where your own boundaries are, where other people's boundaries are, you know, how to deal with both like physical pain and mental pain and get over it yourself, then you're not going to be able to handle things in the real world. So siblings, I feel like it feels to me now abusive to not give a kid more than at least two siblings. It seems like that's really necessary. And I say this as an only child. I mean, I had older siblings, but they were way, way older, so it didn't feel like I had them. And I loved being an only child. I was so spoiled, but it didn't necessarily serve me best.
Gotcha.
I don't want to admit it, but like, because no one wants hardship, right? But it would have been better.
Yeah, but
probably.
Like, I find hardship. Like, you know, if I'll play video games and then I'll set the settings to difficult just so that I have some kind of hardship in the game. And if it's not, if I don't have that hardship, I don't feel any accomplishment or sense of accomplishment if I pass the game. If it's just a cakewalk, there's no point. So I look at life the same way.
That makes sense.
Anyways, any last things we want to bring up?
Great having you on. People should go check out your channel, Sandman. Although, you know, I'd be surprised if any of our listeners haven't heard of you or seen your channel before.
Well, no, you have two channels now. I guess one's kind of dead. Where should people go?
The idea was I would put the old channel was mostly on the first one, but the second one was monetized. So a lot of I didn't want to like pull all the content down and start posting again. It was just a mess. So I started posting new sanitized content on the second one, and that got monetized. And then the first one was also a great target because that's the one that everyone, all the media and all of the haters would target, and they would kind of miss the second one. Well, last week they went after the first and the second one because that's just what they do.
Well,
so how do they go after it, by the way? Do they have like,
well, first I got a warning on Sandman 1. The next day I got a strike on Sandman 1. So I decided, okay, I'm going to make everything private because somebody is obviously like striking my channel. It's either Google or it's somebody doing that. So I didn't post anything for a week. I kind of just took a week off, and then I started, I was going to post again the Tuesday, which was like a couple days ago. A couple days ago, yeah. And all of a sudden, I got a strike on Monday on Sandman 2. Not strike, a warning. So I was expecting a strike on Tuesday. So what I did was I took down all of my non-memes video because they were only striking the non-memes videos. So I deleted those, and then
what
I got up on Tuesday morning.
Were they saying, like, offensive? Or, like, what was the claim? Because you seem to get more
hate info speech, than I hate speech, hate speech. Like, every time, hate speech. So I got to Tuesday, and then I woke up, and there was a message, but it was a strike, but to a video that I already deleted. So the message just kind of disappeared and went into the ether. So somebody did attack it on Tuesday. It did get strike, but there was nothing to strike because I had already deleted the video on Monday. Right. I don't know what's going on. So anyway, I've taken everything and made it private on the Sandman 1 channel, and I'm posting new stuff, but I'm going to make it all public again in about 3 or 4 months. So back when the strikes are and the warnings are gone. And then if they do it again, this is just part and parcel of the game, right?
Well, I mean, I wish it wasn't. Like, I hate doing, like, even with what we get now, when we get all these demonetizations and everything like that, I'm like, I don't appreciate this part of the game. It doesn't feel fair.
Well, just don't use words that trigger them in the titles, and
yeah,
use words.
Maybe it's our fault
when you're talking. Well, that's not your. It's look. This is the
no. Come on, Malcolm is walking down an alley with a tiny little mini skirt, with very drunk, you know, just screaming at the top of his lungs, and he's just so unhappy that that didn't go the way he wanted. You're asking for trouble,
Simone,
friend.
Okay, but here's the situation. Is we haven't actually gotten people trying to take us down yet. Like, I don't know how I would handle being in your situation. I would feel very demotivated. You know, even you just being like, oh, I stopped posting for a week. I'm like, oh my God, I can't imagine.
No, well, okay. If I get a strike on, well, I got a strike on Sandman once. So they tell me I can't, they basically don't allow you to post for a week. But there's, if you read the fine print, it says if you post on any other channel, if you post your content on any other channel, that's also a violation. So I'm like, okay, I'm not going to post, even though I can post on the other channel, I'm not going to post anything. I'm just going to like lay low for a week. Right. And just see what happens. And then like they notice, oh, he's not posting. Let's hit the other channel too. Right. Like the following week.
Wow.
So
what was the claim? Like, how did they get you for hate speech? I guess I'm wondering. Like,
Somebody either YouTube or somebody was just probably complaining on multiple videos. So if you flagged 20 or 30 videos, so if
30 videos,
you can flag 100 videos. You can get like, yeah. Say you contact 10 friends and each one of them flags 10 videos on a channel. One or two of them is definitely going to get a strike. And then once they get the strike, well, then the channel is dead for a week, right? So, you know, it's a striking a brigade or a bunch of people that are just kind of attacking you at the same time. I don't know. I've had people that were constantly... attack or post negative things on a video that I would post every day for like 2 years. So like, you get really fanatical people that just have nothing better to do than to attack you all day.
Oh my gosh.
Do you have like a YouTube rep or something that you can contact?
Well, since I was demonetized, I lost my YouTube rep, right? On my main channel, we have to have over 100,000 subs to get kind of the rep. At least that's how it used to be. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they've changed that or not, but it is what it is. I don't know if it's YouTube doing it or if it's somebody else doing it. That's the worst part.
Yeah, that's really creepy and I don't like it.
And it could also be just because it's the election and they want to silence people because of the election. Because a lot of my memes videos are like talking about politics. So that, but again, they're not being targeted. They're targeting other stuff. You don't know. This is the thing. Like with YouTube, you don't know what you don't know. You just do know that keywords will set off demonetization. So if you use other words for words that would be considered controversial, then you're more likely or less likely to get demonetized on individual videos.
Well, Simone, let's get to 100,000 before we get too many haters.
Yeah, good luck.
I think the majority of your hate's going to come from like just people who don't have kids who are like going to be pissed off because you're doing it and they can't and for whatever reason.
I don't think that's where our hate's going to come from. I mean, we're mostly now known as like leading figures of the new right, and I think it's just going to be lefties.
Oh well. You're smart to not tell people where you're raising your kids. I think that's
Well, Simone's like, oh, we'll have our house attacked eventually, and I know we will. But you know, what do you do, right?
Well,
yeah, like, arm yourself.
Just be careful where you from what I read, I was just like, you guys live in a rural area and a couple houses side by. I'm like, okay, that's all you need to put it. Don't put anything else out there because.
Oh no! Oh. The problem is Simone has run for office. Your address is public when you run for office.
I'm like very doxxed. Yeah.
Well, okay. So YouTube. Okay, so this is the thing. Like YouTube on my first channel, they won't allow me to put links in my description. So they won't allow me to. So unless I send them a copy of my government ID with my photo and my name on it, or I send them a 30-second video of me talking and apologizing. So they're gonna literally get it, like humiliate me and shame me. So this happened like over the last week. So this is how I get like all the privileges back by giving away my. I'm not doing that. I'm gonna wait 2 months for it to kind of expire. Yeah, it's horrible.
Oh my gosh!
Wait, they need you to. They have an apology link or something.
Yeah, they have like 30 seconds. Make a 30-second video of yourself. So doxing is very complicated in the sense that. They need to have a picture and they need to have a name. And those two things like have to be matching up, because anyone can have a picture, but if you have a picture of somebody, but you don't have a name, then it's valueless. Or if you have a name, but you don't have a picture and an address, it also has no value.
Oh, not anymore. Not anymore. There's a great video that you should check out. And I want to do a video on this topic, on the Facebook glasses, and somebody built an AI for them.
That's where, once there's an online connection, Malcolm, but before there's an online connection between the face and the name.
Yeah, but if anybody has a picture of you now, so it showed that when the AI glasses look at somebody, they can pull up all of their social media information and their address really quickly, like just by looking. It's like, oh, this is it. And it was somebody going through like a subway, and they were like, oh, hey, are you X who works at Y company? You know, I know you from X organization that you're on the board of. And the guy was like, oh yeah, it's so great to see you. You know, the standard, because they didn't know. And they could just go through and like know everyone they were looking at. It was crazy.
Okay. Sorry to let you guys go, but there's a birthday. I got to go take care of some stuff.
I got to go anyway.
Enjoy.
Anyway, yeah. So we'll talk again. Okay. All right.
Good. Bye.
Bye.